And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. Today on the program, we are going to be speaking to Fred Jerome, who is the author of Einstein on Israel and Zionism, published by St. Martin's Press. We're also going to be talking to Ken Stone and perhaps a second person who's making this trip to the Global March to Jerusalem, a rather dramatic development this year. It's Palestine Land Day, March 31st. And at the latter part of the program, we will speak to Mahdi Nazimroya. Mahdi Nazimroya is often seen on Russian television. He's also seen in press TV, I think, and he's published in Canada at the globalresearch.ca. Nazimroya was in Libya during the fighting there and the bombardment. And he's a very courageous journalist, but also a keen observer of developments in the Middle East. So we ask him, today we're going to be talking about Syria and the role of Kofi Annan. I said Annan. I'm going to learn how to say this. It's Kofi Annan, and I like it because Annan, they say, rhymes with cannon. So Kofi Annan, so that's Annan cannon, and which that's my own prejudice. I think that he's more trouble than he's not. And we are joined now by Fred Jerome, I think. Are you there, sir?
Yeah, hi, Phil.
How you doing?
Not bad.
you have written a really, you edited a book. You've written a couple of three books, actually, about Albert Einstein. You bring out the side of the qualities of Einstein are not so widely known. You discussed his problems with the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover, and you've also talked about, you have a book about his work with Paul Robeson and others in fighting racism in America. But your most recent book, a very important one, Einstein on Israel and Zionism, is a collection of his thoughts about the Middle East and about the development of the Zionist state. Today, of course, we're curious to know what your reaction is to the news that they're making available on the net. The plan is for all of Einstein's letters, notes, articles, and whatnot. First of all, what do you know about this, and what do you think of this project?
Well, the main thing is it's not a new project. It's been going on for a long time, maybe 10 years, collecting his papers and his letters and so on, and editing them and putting them on the, making them accessible. And I think that what's new about this is that the Hebrew University, which is the home of the archives, the Einstein archives, announced that they would make it all of their archives available online. That is, they accessible.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean that they will put them all online, at least not right away. As I understand, they're only putting the documents written prior to 1921 or up through 1921, which leaves a lot that are not being put online.
Uh-huh.
But that you can access all of them, so that it's certainly a wonderful technological feat, but it's a little bit like having a television set that can get 10,000 channels.
Yes,
and I'm not sure that it enables you to. It doesn't say anything about what Einstein says, or what the documents say, or what you get when you go, online. And it's very hard to. I'd rather be in the archives, going through papers and seeing what's there. If I don't know what I'm looking for, how do I know what to ask for? If I go to the Einstein archive.
Yes, it is interesting how that leads people you end up sort of in the hands of the people who are in charge of it. I noticed that they have, I went to the site, or what I think is the site, because there are three or four sort of access points. And I noticed that there is a sort of a sampling, and my guess is that that's what they assume is going to happen. People will just go to the samples that they've made available.
Uh-huh.
And inevitably, that's an editor's choice. And I noticed that they sort of go between, you might say, the serious and the salacious. When the media wanted to point out that he had letters to mistresses.
Yes.
And then, but also then they got into the issue of, what was his take on Israel, the establishment of Israel?
Yeah.
And I noticed they featured a 1921 letter. That was the first thing I found, was a statement about he thought it was a good idea to have a, I believe he used the word Zionist state. And naturally, we know this is a world full of people very concerned about the Einstein posture and how it might reflect on what they are themselves doing.
I don't know that the letter where he used the word Zionist state. I don't think he did.
Mm-hmm.
I think the 1917, the Balfour Declaration, in fact, the British, when the British announced that they would support a home for Jews in Palestine, that's the way they stated it. They said it would be a home for Jews in Palestine, not a state. They didn't use the word state. They deliberately did not use the word state. And many of the Zionist leaders very consciously, although they said privately, and you can read all this in my book, Einstein on Israel and Zionism, they said privately that they were in favor of a state and they would establish a state. Publicly, they were very careful to say it would be a home, not, and they didn't use the word state, and it would be in Palestine. It would not be the state of Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And Einstein did not, in fact, support the idea of a Jewish state. In fact, he opposed the idea of a Jewish state over and over and over again. And if instead of announcing the fact that the archive will be posted online, they would announce, for example, that Einstein wrote in 1952, after the establishment of Israel, to a Zionist in Brooklyn, that he said, did it not come to your mind that the pilgrims who came from England to colonize the U.S. came to realize a plan very similar to the Zionists' own?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how tyrannical, intolerant, and aggressive these people became after a short while? Being baptized in Jewish water is no protection either. Yeah. That was written in March 17, 1952. There are many more such quotes.
Yeah. Now, and the tie in there also, the fact that of course, these papers exist I guess they're held in university in, is it Jerusalem?
In Jerusalem, yeah. The Hebrew University in Jerusalem.
Now, he turned his papers, gave those papers to a university that was being established in the 1920s or something, right? It wasn't the State of Israel. It was a university.
He was in fact a cultural, what's generally called a cultural Zionist, as opposed to a political Zionist. That is to say, he advocated cultural centers, universities, schools, clubs for Jews, because he felt that it was after the Holocaust that it was important for Jews to have these centers. But he made it very clear that he did not advocate a state for Jews, and said the state idea is not according to my heart. I cannot understand why it is needed. It is connected with many difficulties and narrow-mindedness. I believe it is bad. This is in 1946. Mm-hmm. And I've got quotes from, in 1930, in 1915, 1938, 1952, 1955, when he said the most important aspect of our policy must be our ever-present manifest desire to institute complete equality for the Arab citizens living in our midst, and so on and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So that while he gave his papers to the Hebrew University and he favored the idea of having a university and schools, and it was a cultural Zionist, Zionism, but not a political Zionism. And he made that distinction over and over and over again. And he wasn't the only one who had that. Hannah Arendt is another well-known Zionist who agreed with him, who was also a cultural Zionist and not in favor of a Jewish state.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Einstein was in favor of a binational state.
Yes.
And one of the documents that they mentioned in this recent release.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. By the way, just to remind our listeners, this is Fred Jerome, and he is the editor of Einstein on Israel and Zionism, St. Martin's Press, a terrific book with so many of these letters and comments and speeches by Einstein over the years showing, by the way, his great, I'd say, his consistency. I noticed that that the New York Times and others refer to something they call idealistic side to Einstein and suggesting that he was, out of his element because he was suggesting Arab and Jewish alliance in 1930 that they form, actually. And he seemed to, I assume it's because, of course, it was a British colony. It was almost an incipient anti-colonial idea. And he was saying, let's unite. Did I get that right?
Well, that's true. He, in 1930, he wrote to the Palestinian newspaper, Palestine, advocating a binational council of Jews and Arabs. And he went into great detail. He sort of based it on the Swiss model. And he said that there should be a doctor elected. Each group should have a doctor elected by the medical association, a lawyer elected by lawyers.
Yeah, and a trade unionist elected by trade.
Right, exactly. And that then they should, their meetings should be secret. That is, the content of their meetings, the decisions should be public. But that there wouldn't be a secret council, as some of the reports say. But he did advocate a binational state, and that was very clearly what his position was, and again, he wasn't the only one. And to that, they say, well, that when the New York Times and others speak of that as sort of idealistic, I think it is a reflection of their point of view more than Einstein.
Yeah.
And wasn't until, in fact, they didn't. It wasn't until Einstein died in 1955, and then in his obituary in the New York Times, they first referred to him as a staunch advocate of the State of Israel. It wasn't until after he died that they first said that in print.
When he wouldn't be able to answer them.
Exactly.
He was adopted.
All of their statements about him and by him previously that were published, and there are many of them, say something quite different.
Yeah.
All of which are in my book. Some of them have never been published before. Some of them are letters that had never been published before, but many of his statements had been published before in the Times and elsewhere.
Well, you know, you've emphasized to us previous interviews talking about your terrific book, The Einstein File, where J. Edgar Hoover was on his case,
mm-hmm.
and based on what you're telling us now, you can see why J. Edgar Hoover thought this is a man to watch. And again, I'll just say this is Fred Jerome. He's the editor of Einstein on Israel and Zionism. I did notice that at this site they're featuring an article or book, I don't know what it is, by Zev Rosenkranz. But I got to say, it's got a great title, and I think you could help us with the answer. He says Einstein, a pre-Israel Einstein, a Zionist icon or iconoclast. Not a bad title.
Well, Zev actually has had and still has a good deal of knowledge of Einstein's criticism of Israel, and when he left, he was for a while the curator of the Einstein Archives in Jerusalem at the university, the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Then he left and came to this country and went to work for the Einstein Papers Project in Santa Barbara,
mm-hmm.
but. For a variety of reasons, he has taken the position that Einstein supported Israel after it was founded.
Mm-hmm. But that title, which I know from your writings, and I should say your writings, your assembling of the writings of Einstein, The case is made there out of his own, from his own pen and from his speeches, that he was just simply not a fit with anybody's state because he was a very iconoclastic person.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I think that it's not just on this issue that the his position is as radical as it was, because he was also, thanks to J. Edgar Hoover, we know a lot of this, so we might have known it. We did know it otherwise, but J. Edgar Hoover put it all in one document. That is his FBI file on Einstein. That Einstein was very active in fighting for and criticizing racism in this country and fighting for equal rights for people of color. And he was a good friend of Paul Robeson, for example, for 20 years, something which was never published, never written about outside of the FBI file until we wrote our book.
Thank goodness for the FBI.
Well, it wasn't his intention to make it a good thing, but nonetheless.
Yeah, that we do know. I mean, you pointed out in your writing, I mean, he very courageously took on the fight to end lynching in America, the murder of black citizens by mobs.
In 1946, in fact, it was the year after World War II ended, and there were more than a million black GIs coming back to the U.S. from the war. And many of them, there was a wave of lynchings in America of well over 100 black people were lynched, most of them GIs returning. And it was most of them in the southern states, where it was as if the Nazis, the neo-Nazis who ran the southern states, were saying, don't think because you fought World War II that you're going to be equal, you're going to have equality in this country.
Yeah, and the greatest scientific man of the age took up the fight, and the American media managed to look the other direction.
Right.
Actually,
he and Paul Robeson co-chaired the American crusade to end lynching.
Wow.
In 1946, and organized a demonstration to Washington. In Washington, Einstein was unable to go to the demonstration because of his health, but he sent a letter with Robeson, which was delivered to President Truman when President Truman then to Robeson and the delegation out of the White House because they were a little bit too militant for his taste. And he said there was no need for anti-lynching legislation. Truman said there was no need for anti-lynching legislation at that time.
Not if he wanted to go on being president.
Right. He later changed his position when he thought it would help him get reelected in 1948. Probably did help him get reelected in 1948.
Yeah. Now, I have to ask you, this is Fred Roman, the last question here. Fred is the editor of Einstein on Israel and Zionism, and that's available through St. Martin's Press. It just, of course, this is the magic of the Internet. Just put Fred Roman, you can get the book. He was very clear about one point of view that he held, which, again, the world sort of ignores, but the first edition of the Monthly Review magazine, edited by... Well, now I'm not going to say his name. Well, Leo Huberman, I forget who the other...
Paul Sweezy.
Yeah, the first edition carried a front page that said, Why I Am a Socialist, by Albert Einstein.
Yeah, actually it was called Why Socialism.
Oh, pardon me, Why Socialism.
That's all right. It was written in the first... It was published in the first edition of Monthly Review magazine, which a socialist magazine, which is still published in this country. Mm-hmm. And it was Einstein's full... I mean, he had stated this privately and in letters and so on, but a public statement in 1949.
Yeah, it's more affirmative, of course. I got that wrong, but clearly he's saying we should all be socialists.
That's right. That's right. And it's available online. You can get that, and also in a number of books. It's not hard to get that. It's a very eloquent statement, advocacy of socialism and criticism of capitalism, which now has become a little bit more acceptable the Occupy Wall Street movement.
Exactly. We should pass it out to them and say, guess who's on your side?
Right, exactly.
Well, Fred Jerome, it's a great pleasure talking to you. That's a wonderful book, Einstein on Israel and Zionism.
Thank you, Phil. I'm eager to hear any comments that your readers might have, and they can reach me at the website, www.einsteinonisrael.com, and they can reach me through that or through your station, any way they would like.
Terrific. Thank you. We'll talk to you.
Okay. Thank you, Phil.
Okay. Bye-bye. Fred Jerome. And by the way, the other book he was referring to, The Einstein File, that is a great, great account of the FBI's stalking of Einstein. And by the way, talking about, they were thinking of trying to remove him from the country. It's like they wanted to have a brain operation where they take an axe to their own head and remove it. And amazing. By the way, Phil Conlon is here. Phil, how you doing?
Hi, Phil. Good.
We expect to be hearing from travelers to this march on Jerusalem, but you have an announcement, I believe.
Yeah, tomorrow evening at Beth Zetun at 612 Markham Street, Searching for Democracy in Israel, Canadian playwright Arthur Milner, who recently toured Israel, and this is sponsored by Independent Jewish Voices and the United Jewish People's Organization, and Arthur Milner will talk about his recent travels to Israel and all his upcoming production of his play translated into Arabic, which will be produced in Palestine.
By the way, I'm always doing this too. Do they have the title of that play? Do you know?
Yes. Well, he has two plays. The one they're going to do is Facts. Facts was produced in Canada in 2011 and is going to be produced in the West Bank and in Israel in Arabic translation in this coming July. His first play was called Masada. So you can see this guy likes to challenge you just with the title of his of his plays.
Yeah. Yeah, well, so that's tomorrow night.
At 7 p.m. at Beth Zetun at 612 Markham Street.
At Beth Zetun.
$5 admission. See, that's
very good
admission price. You know?
I attended the Canada Boat to Gaza meeting yesterday. David Heap was there, and it was really a boost to see these people in the flesh who had all that courage and made that effort. I think we're joined by Ken Stone. Are you there, Ken?
I am, Phil.
Hey, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
You are saying why I'm going to the Mideast for the Global March to Jerusalem, which is going to be on March 31st with Palestinian landing. So
it's March 30th, Phil.
Oh, March 30th. Thank you. So when? Why are you going? And tell us about it.
Well, the Global March to Jerusalem is a global day of protest, a global day of action about Jerusalem and the problems that are being encountered there by the Palestinians, especially the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, of Jerusalem, the demolition of Arab homes, and the placing of the apartheid wall, which effectively cut off half of the Arab citizens from the city of Jerusalem, the restricted access to non-Jewish places of worship, and the right of return of the Palestinian refugees to Palestine in general. So it's going to take place all over the world. It's going to be focused on the Middle East. There'll be marches in the occupied territories on the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. There's going to be a march of people beyond the 48 line, within the 48 line, the green line, of Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs who are actually going to march to Jerusalem. In all the border countries, there's going to be marches, big marches. And around the world, there's going to be solidarity events on Palestinian Land Day, which is March 30th.
And where's your starting point? Where will you begin to be going from and to?
I'm going to Beirut. And from Beirut, there's going to be a big mobilization, and people are going to be bused down to the Beaufort Castle, which is I've never been to. It's a crusader fort. That's right. And it overlooks Palestine. And we have the official permission of the Lebanese government to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So they're expecting thousands of people, and they are expecting to do this for a whole day of activities at the Beaufort Castle.
Wow. And again, now the focus, this is also the... something was established in 1976, was it, the Palestine Land Day?
That's right. On March 30th, 1976, the Palestinians had a national day of protest. These are Palestinians who were Israeli citizens, and they were protesting the fact that the Israeli government was seizing thousands of acres, hectares, I think they call them dunams, mm-hmm. of Palestinian land for, quote, security and settlement purposes, unquote. And so there were demonstrations up and down the country of Palestine at that time, and there was even a general strike by the workers of the Palestinian workers that day. And in the demonstrations and the activity, the Israelis, if I have my numbers right, killed six demonstrators. They arrested scores and wounded scores more.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pivotal event in the history of Palestine, in the same way that Sharpeville was a pivotal event in the history of fighting apartheid in South Africa.
I just mentioned you have some pretty interesting sponsors, Desmond Tutu, and who are some of the others? I think I saw the name George Galloway.
George Galloway, Nobel Peace Prize winner, Married McGuire. UN Special Rapporteur Richard Falk, Cindy Sheehan, the anti-war activist, Noam Chomsky, and there's about 120 more prominent people from around the world who've endorsed this officially.
Mm-hmm. I think you mentioned you might have someone else there who was also going to say something. Is she there?
Yes, my friend and colleague, Hala Ibrahim from Hamilton. Here she is.
Oh, thank you very much, Ken Stone.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi. Thank you for taking the time. It's an exciting moment for you. Where's your destination, and what do you anticipate?
Yes, it's very exciting, that's for sure. My destination is to Amman, Jordan.
Mm-hmm. And will they march from Amman, or how do you picture it unfolding?
I think it will unfold really well, and I'm hoping that it will. The media will cover it properly.
Mm-hmm.
We will be going to the Alembi Bridge, where the Israeli border is, and we're hoping for a great turnout and a peaceful march.
Yeah. It's certainly, by the way, we've all over the years heard mention of Palestine Land Day, but this is going to be the biggest thing that's ever happened on this occasion.
Well, it's great, and I'm really happy about that. Yes, it's going to be a big one.
There's a gentleman, Mr. Barghouti is one of the sponsors, is he not?
Mr. Barghouti?
Did I get his name right? A Palestinian?
That's right. You did have, Barghouti, yes.
Yeah. I actually don't know much about him. Could you roughly describe him?
Describe him as in?
Yeah, his politics, et cetera. What's his title, et cetera?
Well, I'm not sure if we have enough time to describe Mr. Barghouti. I know he's a very he's an activist, and mm-hmm. he's all for peace.
Didn't he had
he's a good speaker.
Yes. I noticed he's become quite prominent in recent years. I guess he was a political prisoner for a while, was he not?
He was a political prisoner for a long time, that's right.
Yeah.
Now, he wasn't the only one, obviously. There is over 10,000 young men in Israeli prisons.
Mm-hmm.
And my brothers were one of those prisoners.
Well,
so this one touches me really, touches my heart. It's very personal to me.
Yeah. We're speaking to Kuala Ibrahim.
Yes.
By the way, it must be a very empowering thing. You've been through such difficulty, Palestinian yourself, and you had brothers who were in prison. It must be good to be part of a worldwide effort.
It is great to be part of this global march.
Mm-hmm.
I am really looking forward to it. I am hoping for a great turnout, which it will be.
Mm-hmm.
And we're hoping for a very nice and peaceful march.
Yeah. Well, so do we. And we look forward to talking to you when you come back, because I think you're going to have some great stories for us.
I always do.
Well, thank you very much. You have a safe trip, and we hope you have a very successful march.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kuala. Kuala Ibrahim. And she was going to be marching from Amman, Jordan. This is really turning into something. When I first heard of it, I said, is this possible?
Is there going to be an event in Toronto? And I don't know if Ken mentioned that.
Yes, there's going to be supporting meetings and some marches. And on that, we'll just have to – if it is going to be March 30.
Right.
I know they're doing something in Montreal. Mm-hmm. I know because –
Well, they're doing a lot in Montreal these days.
Montreal's always – remember last week we had the young woman from McGill University?
Yeah.
And You know that they had a demonstration of 250,000 people. It was 4 kilometers long, the march. And something is afoot.
Yeah, and you know, I mean,
you know,
the press.
By the way, we have a situation where we just have a new NDP leader, yeah. and there are so many phenomena such as that. That was not the focus of what they're doing.
No, you didn't. You would never know that it was going on.
Yeah, right? They should have. Everybody who went to that microphone should have said, "You know, bless those students and workers and people who got in the streets of Montreal demanding a more equal system." And respect that respects workers and the right of every child to a higher education. They should have all been at the mic saying that, but they didn't.
Yeah.
So the 99% are in the street, and the 1% are still talking like 1% people. We're going to take a quick break. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We'll be right back.
Everyone rushes to support the CIUT Spring Membership Drive. Beat the rush. Donate in advance right now at www.ciut.fm. Donate via PayPal or your credit card. Thanks to you, we're still 25 years and counting. From the roots up.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto. Presenting the history and evolution of sound for 25 years and counting. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
And we're back, as we promised. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And as you were hearing, by the way, we are 25 years and counting. And growing, and coming up in April, we're going to be doing, because we're a public program. We count on the public, so we'll be doing fundraising. So we're going to tell you right now that you can start getting ready to help out. And indeed, you could even help out anytime you like. But April will be the time.
You think Peter Monk would give us any money this year, Phil?
He didn't last year, and I don't know what's going on with him.
Yeah.
How
about Jerry?
He cracked it out.
He
didn't have a problem with Mulcair. Yeah. I don't get it. I mean, we're all on the same team.
So, folks, our listeners, you're going to have to contribute this year because Peter Monk is probably not going to come through for us.
Yeah, again, you know, with all those letters, nothing. Yeah. Just sitting out there and waiting. By the way, I just remind you, we're waiting for the next. We're going to be speaking to Madi Nazimroya shortly. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and you can check us out on the web at taylor-report.com. And we are joined now by Madi Nazimroya, a very courageous and well-known Canadian journalist. You've seen him on Russian television and also at globalresearch.ca. His articles, and he was in Libya when the bombs are falling. He's with us now. Are you there, Madi?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yep, we hear you. You're coming through loud and clear. Madi, we want to know what you make of the developments around Syria. I guess, first of all, I'd like to know, what is your take on the so-called military situation? Only a couple of weeks ago, Hillary Clinton was salivating at the thought that they were going to knock over the government there, and it hasn't seemed to happen. Can you tell us, what do you know about the degree of fighting? Is it declined, or what's
the
status?
They've been defeated in homes and around homes. They're still in the country, of course, and the United States. News has come out that the United States and France have been sending weapons. This isn't new, of course. Everybody was aware of this. But this news has come out. They're still fighting there. We shouldn't be surprised about it. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, fortunately, Hillary Clinton is not going to get her way. And that's that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to point out that this is the person who said that this is the person who said when Gaddafi died, said yes. So this person likes blood. You know, this is not a good person at all. And like somebody who encourages death and mayhem is not somebody that you'd like to have representing your country on the international stage.
Yeah, we do have a kind of a striking moment in history, don't we? We're the most powerful country on the earth. The leader of it thinks he has the right to say that people should just step down because he wants them to step down. He has a Secretary of State that celebrates when someone is murdered.
Brutally murdered. She watched it. Mm-hmm. She found out. She watched it. Everybody remembers her reaction during the interview. Yes, her hands were up. And then when the rest of the world's outraged, it's such a barbaric act, she changes her tune. Yes. This is no friend of freedom or liberty. This is an aggressive warmonger.
Yeah, and by the way, now they've organized a meeting, one already in Tunisia, and there's one coming up in Turkey. They advertise, the title of the meeting is The Friends of Syria, but Syria is not invited. I mean, it sounds like identity theft, doesn't it?
This is not the Friends of Syria. This is the Friends and Proxies of the United States meeting. They should call it the Proxies and Friends of the United States of America. These are the U.S.'s satellites and allies. They're not the friends of the Syrian people. They don't care anything about the Syrian people. In this last year, actually, since 2011 till now, 2012, we have a whole bunch of people now saying they love the Syrian people, blah, 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 in Washington, Brussels, Paris, London. These people didn't even care about the Syrian people 3 years ago. But now they love the Syrian people. They don't love the Syrian people. They want to control the Syrian people, and they want to bring blood to their country.
Yes. Also, how can they get away with it? And by the way, when I say get away with it, I'm speaking of members of the Canadian Parliament and others who talk about economic sanctions against Syria, about supporting rebels. And allegedly, this has something to do with democracy. But the leading organizers against Syria in the region are all absolute monarchs.
They're all dictatorships. You don't hear anything about Saudi Arabia. You don't hear anything about Bahrain. But the United States claims that it stopped sending weapons to Bahrain, but I know what it did. It actually sent the weapons to Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia gave them to Bahrain. It gets around these things by this trickery. Mm-hmm. You know, it supports the most ruthless, bloodthirsty regimes in the world that have killed their own people, appropriated property and wealth. And then it comes lecturing about Syria, where there's a state that has benefits for the people. I'm not going to tell you that Syria is heaven, but I'm going to tell you that what they want in Syria has nothing to do with democracy or human rights. They're the ones who support terrorism there. They're the ones who supported terrorism in Iraq. They're the ones who support slaughter. I was in Libya, and if they want to do what they did in Libya, no thank you.
Yes. And by the way, I mean there is this issue of Syria is a very complex political culture in which there are Christians, there are different schools of Islam, and there are many refugees who have been quietly there and being made secure by the state that is under attack.
There's a lot of Iraqi and Palestinian refugees, as well as, believe it or not, Turkish refugees from the state of Turkey who left to the fighting in southeastern Turkey, who also live in parts of Syria. So the Turks, when they talk about all those Syrian refugees, should remember that there's people, Turkish citizens, specifically Kurds and some other minorities who live in Syria who left Turkey as refugees there. Turkey should have posture about democracy when it never gave Kurds the right speak their own languages, and other minorities as well, or try to appropriate their identities and impose a Turkish identity on them by calling them Mountain Turks. The Turkish military still puts martial law into effect in southeastern Turkey, which is called Turkish Kurdistan. You know, but Syria is a diverse country, like you said. There's the majority of the Muslims belong to the Sunni school. There's also a large Shiite minority, which is mostly Alawite, but there's also Ismaili Shiites and 12 or so-called Jafari Shiites, which are the same type in Lebanon and Iran and Iraq. But the Shiites plus the Christians, and they have two types of main groups of Christians. That's they have Eastern Catholics, they're part of the broader Roman Catholic Church type of that stamp, but they have local patriarchs and they have autonomy. Amongst them is the Maronite Church, the Greek Catholic.
Catholic Melkite Church. And there's also the Eastern and Orthodox Oriental Orthodox churches. So there's the Greek Orthodox Church. There's the Syriac, different Syriac Orthodox churches. So it's a, and there's also the Druze and a Jewish minority as well in Syria. These minorities put together make up 35% of the country's population.
Yeah, and the people leading the so-called revolt have been very bigoted towards about 8 out of 10 of those.
Well, what they do say in Syria is that, well, they, first of all, the people leading the revolt don't represent, I don't think they represent the Sunnis at all. They're not representative. But anyway, what I want to point out about the people leading this revolt is that, first of all, some of the chants they're making are very bigoted. The chants go like this: Alawites to the ground, which means death, yet bury them, and Christians to Lebanon, which means leave Syria. Those are the chants they're making. Are these the people you want to support?
Yeah.
Who are talking about killing about 30% of the population or kicking them out of the country?
And Sarkozy and Obama are providing weapons to those people.
Well, Sarkozy and Obama have provided weapons to the most ruthless people all over the world.
Yeah, I remember your reporting from Libya, which exactly made that point, and it's been, now we're living with the ugly consequences. And now I have to ask you, Kofi Annan has been in Russia, and he has this so-called six-point proposal. What do you make of his role?
I looked at the six-point proposal. It's also in the last in a UN resolution that was passed, non-binding, of course. Mr. Annan is also, who's the former Secretary General, is also going to Beijing if he's not there right now. He was in Ottawa in November, and I happened to follow the platform he was on at the conference. The conference was actually at my former university, the University of Ottawa, and he was there with Lloyd Axworthy, who was Canada's former foreign minister. He was also there with Christopher Abrams, I believe. His last name is Aberdeen, sorry, who is the secretary to the defense minister of the conservative government of Mr. Harper. They sat on a platform there hosted by a member of the BBC, World Service, and Alan Rock was also there. I got informed about this meeting, this conference, because Alan Rock and Lloyd Axworthy released a press release and a report in the Ottawa Citizen saying that responsibility to protect and humanitarian intervention have succeeded. Libya is a wonderful case.
Oh,
and
my.
They basically said, look, wow, look what we're doing. And that conference was about humanitarian intervention. It was held by the Center for International Policy Studies at the University of Ottawa, and it was on, like I said, in November 2011. But why I'm saying 1999 is because I know that Kofi Annan owes his rise to the United States.
Absolutely.
Of his involvement in Bosnia and the accusations of genocide in Srebrenica. And if anybody follows that and read the report that the UN made, it's called The Fall of Srebrenica, from November 1999, and it was handed out to the UN General Assembly, it says it's in there.
Mm-hmm. Look,
Bill Clinton told the leader of the Alija, I can't say the last name, the leader of the Bosniaks, which are commonly called Bosnian Muslims, but it's more properly Bosniaks.
Mm-hmm.
He told them, if there's 5,000 deaths, NATO will intervene. So we need 5,000 deaths. So this is their strategy: death, and we intervene. That's the same thing they did to the KLA. I was just reading the Montreal Gazette a report from, I believe, 2000. It was 2000, just a few months after the war. Somebody from the BBC said Madeleine Albright told the leader of the KLA the same thing: we need these deaths. What happened in Libya? They lied about 6,000 people being killed, and they intervened. In Syria, too, they want deaths, and that's why they keep on. The opposition doesn't want peace talks. And when I mean the opposition, I mean the Syrian National Council is essentially a front former regime officials and the Muslim Brotherhood, the Syrian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. That's what it is. They put some liberals in there who've lived outside the country, have no ties to it, don't even know what's going on in Damascus or any of the other major Syrian cities. But anyway, back to Mr. Annan. Mr. Annan, Kofi Annan, has been one of the people who's advocated for humanitarian intervention. In fact, at the conference, he said he was for the intervention in Libya. You know, this is a man who was involved in Rwanda, too. This is a man who was involved with the UN oil scandal. His son was involved in this. So this is a man who helped fashion responsibility to protect, who supports it openly, and they made him the advocate, the special envoy for the Arab League and the UN. No, this is ridiculous. The Chinese and the Russians and the other countries involved have to wake up. Because Kofi Annan is just like Ban Ki-moon. You can't really trust him.
Well,
you know,
and people have to remember the Ivory Coast, and you folks covered it, remember very well, globalresearch.ca, and we're speaking to Mahdi Nazimroya, but they ended up where Ban Ki-moon actually used UN helicopter gunships to attack the presidential palace. Amazing.
Well, Ban Ki-moon also intervened and broke his stance of neutrality by telling every Mediterranean state on Israel's behalf not to let any of those flotillas go. You know, this is the type of people we have in the bureaucracy of the United Nations. You know, it's people that the United States puts in there because it's the major paymaster. It has the largest numbers when it comes to the vote, right? Because it has all these little islands and client states that vote with it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it imposes these secretary generals or director generals in the case of the International Atomic Energy Agency, who've been making false statements about Iran, political reports that have nothing to do with the technical facts on the ground, that are misappropriating the facts and giving misinformation. Anyways, I think I'm steering off course, but the point is that Kofi Annan was a very bad choice, and I want to add something that listeners might not know. It's that Mr. Annan and Lloyd Axworthy mentioned something new about Response Cities Protect in November 2011 at their conference at Ottawa, which Alan Rock was also present for. At this conference, they said that we should have regionalized intervention, which means we should use the African Union to intervene in Africa for us, and we should use the Arab League to intervene in places like Syria and Lebanon for us. So this is the type of stuff that Mr. Annan is into. And like I said, if I was the Chinese or the Russians or any of their allies or any independent state of the United Nations, I would really take a second look at Kofi Annan. But they're playing politics. You know, this is the diplomatic game. And I don't know where it's going to go, but this is where Kofi Annan comes from, and we should know this. And he was sitting there with a member of the Conservative Party, an MP. By the way, this is the secretary to the defense minister, the man I mentioned, the member of parliament who's speaking with Kofi Annan. But before this, he was also the UN representative in Kabul. He was the representative of the United Nations in Kabul. So like this is the type of people they put in these positions. People tied to the military, you know.
And very
he
trusted.
He was also the Canadian ambassador to Afghanistan.
Yeah. No, that is a remarkable story, Mahdi. We spoke to you some time back, and you thought you might be going to Syria. Are you going to be?
If everything works out, I will be in Syria next month.
Yeah. Well, we're sure going to follow your writing. We appreciate it very, very much. It's very enlightening. Thanks again for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, I want to say one last thing very fast.
Whatever.
I walked down I'm on the side of my house talking to you, so if there's a bit of noise, I apologize for that.
Yeah. Nope. It gave it local color. We appreciate it.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Mahdi. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Mahdi Nazimroya. I am grateful that he cleared that up, because We were all listening intently. He's got a great voice, and he was getting through. But I said, what could this be? So he explained, it's wind.
So I'm turning over in my head Lloyd Axworthy's idea of locally designating the responsibility to protect.
Colonialism.
Yeah. Well, something tells me, though, that he's holding a little back there, right? Does that mean, for instance, the Russians can go in and protect the Russian minority in the Baltic states? Is that what Mr. Axworthy has in mind? Or the Chinese could protect the Filipinos who are in the middle of a civil war? I don't think that's what he had in mind.
I don't think you didn't get the attention of the chair for that question.
Oh, Lloyd.
No, Robert's Rules of Order. You can't ask questions that embarrass the gang. That's you know, you really realize you're dealing with a kind of a mob because all of us immediately, our mind goes to the mob when we think of this because you say, hey, will that apply to my neighborhood? I say, hey, what's he doing? who let him in the meeting, huh? You know, that's really what it is. I'm going to remind our listeners that Marlon Brando, when he got the character, played the role of Mr. Corleone, they said, well, you were brilliant. How did you kind of create that character? And he said, I just imagine what it'd be like to run the State Department. And the New York Times wrote an editorial saying that was in very bad taste. Mr. Brando, who is an actor, ought not to be making comments about people, who do have serious jobs like killing people, taking over their oil. But they said, because, of course, Brando said he thought that's what it was about. He thought that The Godfather was about how the world is run. And
he's right.
Of course, he was speaking out of place. Yes. which is apropos of what you had to say, which is, they've decided on this colonial division of labor. And a favorite issue of this program has been to talk about these international tribunals that they've established. They're very colonial in the way they operate. Everyone understands. The ICC has been in existence for 10 years, and everybody takes their hat off. Isn't this great international justice? I guess so, because only black people are being prosecuted. And they've had one conviction, an African. And it has become nakedly obvious that the only people you can mug are Africans so far. And that's what this is all about. But I pointed out something from my having worked at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. I noticed something, which is that not only will you be convicted by this ad hoc United so-called International Court, but then you will be put in a jail wherever they feel like. So, for example, we have a political crisis unfolding now in Mali. There are UN prisoners in Mali. They're sitting there. I don't know what's going to happen with them, but most people don't even realize they're not Malians. And the reason you had the tribunal in Tanzania was because you said you didn't trust the government of Rwanda to have fair, to be just. And we would know that a good reason for that, since the president, a woman who wanted to run for president, is sitting in prison for having wanted to run for president. So the people convicted in that court are put in Benin, put in Mali, or scattered around. And they have loved ones. They have family. But it's a colonial system. In the old days when the British had their empire, if you gave them a hard time in Canada, for example, they send you to Australia. If you were Irish, the Irish ended up all over the place because it's a British empire, right? And so they just say, well, you're convicted, and since we have an empire, we'll put you over here. And because it's camouflaged as international, the poor citizen of whatever country cannot – their loved one is taken from them and put somewhere where they can't go because you can't walk across the street and go see him in prison. He's the master of the empire has sent him somewhere. So that's a sorry situation we have. Phil, I got to make sure I ask you, what do you know about the library workers? Because they're very dear to our hearts,
Well, they certainly are dear to our hearts, and they provide the one public service more than any other that marks the distinction of us as a civilized society insofar as we are civilized here. In some ways, I don't think we've done very well in that department, but they certainly help. Basically, the library board, which responds to Doug Ford, or rather Rob Ford, one of the twin mayors.
He doesn't know the difference between Tim Hortons and the library.
And those guys, of course, are suspicious of libraries because it means people study and learn things, and that's not good news for the Fords. Mm. They never bothered with that themselves. They made a very, very insulting offer to the union of the library workers. The library has, since the megacity came in 10 years ago and six or seven libraries got melded into one, the library has been stripped of its professionalism. It is now at the point with more than half of the workers there are part-time, casual, people who have no job security, no reason to stay there recently except that the job market is so lousy that but we're returning to an era when the librarian and the school teacher were poor people. You know, you gave the teacher an apple because the teacher didn't make very much money, right? Now, they haven't gotten there yet with the teachers, although I think that's on their agenda. But they've gotten there now with the librarians. Not that the full-time librarians are being paid low wages. It's just you can't get a job as a full-time librarian. You can get a part-time job. You can get a couple hours a week for 6 months, and then you can reapply and that sort of stuff. So, and behind that, of course, it gives the library board the possibility of cutting services, shutting down libraries. And the union says that's what this strike is all about, that the demands that the city has made of them, the demands that Mr. Ford has made of them, only make sense if the intention of the city is to reduce library services. And, of course, the mouthpiece for city council or that wing of city council, because there's some very good people on city council, but the mouthpiece for the Fordites is, no, we have no intention of doing that, to which we then ask the question, well, then why are you asking the union to consent to this? Because if you say you don't need these powers, why are you asking for them? That's basically what the strike is about. Yeah. Actually, they're striking for the public's access to books, and I think that's a marvelous thing.
And civilization.
And for civilization.
Well, I can recite Hugh McDermott, a war to save civilization, you say. And what have you to do with it, pray? Some attempt to acquire it would show greater love than fighting for something you know nothing of. By the way, Mr. Fiorito in the Star had a very nice column about making exactly your point. He said, if you don't intend to lay people off, why are you asking for the power to lay people off? I'm sure they don't get back to him on a question of that type. It's very important to have all of those questions we've asked, like the one you did earlier, that so that we can make a list of the things they never answer to us. I want to make sure, too, we say something. We ought to compliment the stars of the Miami Heat, particularly Mr. LeBron James, for having their picture taken wearing a hood, saying, look, if this makes you a target, any one of us can be shot, and America's love of guns and love of and racial notions. People say I fired because I felt threatened. Well, you have to understand, in a racially charged society where you have white chauvinism dominant, you can tell by the number of black prisoners. That means that you basically have a kind of an apartheid brain. So if they see a black person, they think that they better start thinking about harming them. So it's very good that LeBron James took the stand he did. And also to the former governor of Michigan, or is it Minnesota? But anyhow, she has a radio program, but I noticed that she appeared the other day wearing a hood. And good for her.
And by the way, along with LeBron James was Chris Bosh, who, of course, played here in Toronto.
Yeah, and actually the whole team.
The whole team.
LeBron James led the charge, but his teammates. And also, by the way, they began to do things like text on their shoes. And, you know, the NBA is really tough on people making statements, but so far they haven't told them don't. Because, actually, you could have an uprising in that country easily. You can if this is going to go on. And as typical, when white power types push their luck, American people actually eventually something erupts. Like, well, there was a thing called Civil War. You heard about that. And that will happen. Phil Conlon, thank you very much. And Carol, as usual, thanks very, very much. This is Phil Taylor for the Taylor Report. Write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And check us out, taylor-report.com. And thanks to Fred Jerome and Madi Nazimroy and Ken Stone.